One group that has been very active within the Big Ten schools is called the CIC Honor Subcommittee. This is a group that started in the early 60s. It was really begun by Dick Marsh at the University of Illinois, who served as a beginning chairman. Once a year, the honors chairman of the Big Ten schools meet on campus someplace. One year it's held with the campus of an institution, and the following year it's always held at the university or in Chicago. Normally it's arranged by Sam Schrage at the Illinois Chicago Circle Institution. He makes the arrangements. We meet starting on a Friday noon through a Saturday noon, and again it's mostly a matter of sharing information and ideas. If one school has developed a special approach to one of the problems of honor, such as financial aid for the senior honors thesis, we explain what we're doing. This has worked out very well, and we've all benefited from it and learned from one another. The current chairman is Warner Chapman at Indiana University, and it's a group that I felt very close to because it was a small group, and meeting as we did for 16 or 17 years, we all got pretty well acquainted with one another. We could let our hair down and tell about our own problems and difficulties. We were really honest with each other and indicated not only the merits of honors, but also some of the problems and difficulties that we faced.
So this was a useful...
It was a very good group, and it's still functioning. We tried somewhat the same procedure with honors programs within the UW system, but it hasn't worked out very well. The first year, which was about 4 or 5 years ago, we sent out notices to all of the 13 institutions in the UW system, and we had a fairly good response from most of them. We met on the campus here, again, on a Friday-Saturday arrangement. We had good turnout, and we explained what each school was doing. There weren't too many of the other institutions that had honors programs. Milwaukee had one, Whitewater, the Wausau Center, but that was about it. We hoped that the idea of meeting annually would take, and it did for two or three years. We met the following year at Stevens Point, the year after that at Whitewater, and then there was supposed to be a meeting at Wausau, but that fell through for some reason, and I don't know if there have been any meetings since then. I don't believe so. But it did seem to me that this would be desirable to have the honors people in the UW system meet annually just to share ideas and suggestions.
So this is still going on?
As far as I know, I'm not sure that it met this last year. I just haven't checked with Barbara Wiley.
While we're still on the matter of honors, I came across a term called the sophomore honors. Now, you've explained that the students entering as freshmen could begin an honors program. What's different about sophomore honors?
Sophomore honors is really the first award a student in the honors program can earn. Any student who has completed 20 credits of honors work by the end of his sophomore year, that is within the first 60 credits, so it's a third of the work must be in honors, and has taken courses, at least one honors course in the field of humanities, one in social studies, one in sciences, is awarded sophomore honors. And this is an award that goes on the official transcript. It's recorded there. It's also recorded on a plaque in Bascom Hall that's posted each year. And it's just an attempt to indicate that these are students who have satisfied at least the first half of the requirements for the honors degree. I think I indicated earlier that to earn the honors degree, a student must have 40 credits of honors work and complete the requirements within his major department, including the writing of a thesis or satisfactory substitution. But this is just the first award that a student can get in the honors program.
Sort of a halfway mark?
That's right, yeah. And it's something to, 4 years seems like a long time to students to get an award of any kind, and this is one attempt to give them an intermediate award halfway through their career.
Now, did you originate this?
No, this was all part of the original legislation. That's been pretty constant right from the beginning of the program in 1960.
Well, now you've talked about all the things that have happened. Now, I'm sure there must have been some difficulties and problems along the way. Could we go into that a little bit?
Well, I suppose the biggest problem was the drop in the number of honors courses as a result of budget cuts in the middle 1970s and thereafter. I indicated that the real value of the honors program is the opportunity to elect honors courses, which are more demanding and more challenging. We had a fair number of those in the beginning of the program and up to the middle 70s. Then, when budgets began to be cut, departments hesitated to offer the honors courses because they were small and didn't attract a large number of students. As a result, I think the program was hurt badly. Every year, when we gave our report at the LNS Faculty Senate meeting, I urged that more efforts be put into the offering of honors courses, and did my pleading as earnestly and urgently as I could, but we still didn't have much success. And I would say that that's been one of the real problems that the honors program has faced, was the drop in honors courses. It meant that more and more students were earning honors credit by merely writing a term paper for their professor and getting honors credit, and that was not our idea of real honors work. So that's been the biggest problem that we faced. Then a second problem, and this one came about just as I retired, was the loss of our honors office.
Was that a budget thing too?
Well, I don't think it really was, no. The honors office was located in 301 South Hall. This was an end office that consisted of a reception room and two small offices, one for Barbara Wiley, my assistant, and one for myself. But this was sort of the honors home. Students knew that they could come to that office, see the secretary, and then immediately see either Dean Wiley or myself. And students did make great use of it. As I mentioned earlier, I think one of the important emphases that we stressed in our program was counseling, so we got to see the students. Well, in the last year of my career, the 79-80 year, I learned from Dean Young that they were contemplating taking over that office to make a reception room for the regular dean's, academic dean's office. It meant that the secretary would be placed in one of the side offices. It happens in this case that she's now in Dean Wiley's office. And Dean Wiley and whoever assisted her to replace my position were going to be given offices down the hall, but away from the reception room. This I objected to strenuously, to Dean Young and also to Dean Cronin, but to no avail. The change was made in spite of the fact that both the faculty and student honors committee objected to the change. But it was felt that this was a desirable change from the standpoint of the other office, although in my judgment it hurt the honors office materially. And I still feel that way, and I think that Dean Wiley still feels that way.
Who was pushing it then?
It was really Dean Young. Dean Young was the one who had convinced Dean Cronin that this was necessary and desirable, and in spite of all the evidence I presented to indicate other alternatives, which I thought would be more desirable, it didn't get to first base. Subsequently, I think they found out that they didn't need all that space, because one of the rooms that I had suggested being used for a reception room eventually was used as a sort of an extra reading room for the honors program, which we didn't even want because we didn't think there was any need for it. And how it's being used now, I don't know. I do know, too, that the review committee that Dean Cronin appointed last year to assess the honors program also believes in their report that it would be desirable to have a center for the honors program where there would be an honors office with the secretary and the honors deans together. I think that works out much better.
Well, it seems logical to me. I'm surprised since Young isn't he head of the honors program following you?
He's the acting chairman of the honors, faculty honors committee, but actually he's a figurehead. I mean, that he has the title, but it's Dean Wiley and Dean Miller who are really doing the work of the honors program.
So he doesn't sound as committed as you were.
I don't think he's as committed as I was. And I think it takes somebody who's willing to fight for a program like that. Just as people in the ILS program had to fight for their survival, I think that any program of this type requires somebody who's willing to really go to bat and to fight for it, and that I was willing to do, and I don't think that Dean Young is doing that.
Well, do you see any likelihood that the program might get its room back sometime?
I don't know. I hope so. I hope that that when Dean Cronin acts on the report of this committee that he himself appointed to review the program, that he will see that there's a real desirable feature in being able to have one office that's called the Honors Office, where the students and deans and secretary can all work together.
That sounds like a nice projection.
We thought it worked very well, and that's the way it was set up right from the very beginning. But I suppose that Dean Young and Dean Cronin felt that change is desirable sometimes, although I don't think you change something just when it's working as well as it worked before.
Well, you mentioned just a minute ago about the drop in numbers of honors courses due to budgeting and so forth, but initially, did you have any difficulty getting departments to offer honors courses? Did they have to be persuaded, or?
Well, see, at that time, when the program started, Professor Alvin Whitley of the English Department was the chairman, and I was merely a member of the committee. I don't think that they had a great deal of difficulty in getting departments to offer honors courses, because the program had been approved by the LNS faculty, and at that time, Dean Ingram was still dean of the college. He was a staunch supporter of the program. I think that Professor Whitley did an excellent job of getting it organized and getting it started. I think that the deans are varied in their enthusiasm for honors work. I think that Dean Epstein was a staunch supporter of the program and gave it all the aid it needed. On the other hand, I always felt that Dean Claney had little interest in the honors program, just as I think he had little interest in student problems generally. So that we find a great deal of difference. Dean Cronin was very much interested in the honors program. In fact, his son, Bill, earned an honors degree and wrote a senior honors thesis. In fact, he was one of the students who earned one of the early NAP grants to write his thesis. And I think that he did support the program. But it varies. And as I say, I think that it really came about that the budget cuts during Dean Cheney's career as dean was the beginning of the drop in the honors courses.
Did you work with any dean who was sort of completely wishy-washy about it?
No, I would say not, except that I would say that Dean Ingram was most supportive. I guess I'd have to say that Dean Cheney was least supportive. I think too that perhaps the Faculty Honors Committee did not take enough of a role in supporting, and not in supporting, but in running the honors program. And that probably was my fault, because as chairman, I acted for the committee largely. I hope that if a new organizational arrangement is determined, that the Faculty Honors Committee will be given more responsibility for taking the initiative, instead of having the chairman in the honors program or in the dean's office. I think it'd be better to have the chairman someone from the faculty itself and not one of the deans in the dean's office.
Yeah, that seems like.
I should have mentioned too a little bit more about the student honors committee. I don't think I mentioned that, but we...
Just checking. I don't think you went into that.
Well, there's a student honors committee that's appointed each year. Two freshmen are elected by the current members of the committee, one man and one woman. They stay on the program, or they stay on the committee until they graduate, so that means that they really spend 3.5 years on the committee. So we have two freshmen, two sophomores, two juniors, two seniors. And these eight students act as sort of a sounding board for the students, making suggestions to revise a program or to consider new requirements. They help a great deal in the fall registration procedure with new freshmen. In fact, we actually have them meet with small groups of new honors freshmen. And the members of the honors committee I found to be very conscientious and hardworking and very helpful. It's been one of the real values of working with the group, because being such a small group and getting to work with them for 3.5 years, by the time they're seniors, you know them pretty well.
Well, I would think so. Did you have this arrangement the whole time you were chairman?
I think we started it in the early 60s. It was not set up officially as part of the original regulations or planning of the committee, the way the Faculty Honors Committee was. But this was something that Dean Wiley and I felt was desirable in terms of getting to know the students better and getting the value of their judgments in many of these areas.
Well, now, it sounds like you have two groups here. You have the student group and the faculty group.
That's right.
Did they meet together?
Occasionally. Not regularly, but maybe once a year they would meet together. The faculty committee actually did not meet very often, and again, that may have been my fault. I think I have an explanation for it, and that's that for the two of us, Dean Wiley and me, to try to see and take care of 1,300 students, we didn't have a lot of time to do many other things that we would have liked to do. For example, getting out a newsletter, as many of the schools have done in terms of their honors programs. And we just didn't have time to do that. So that the faculty honors committee Its primary responsibilities were the selection of the students to get the awards for senior honors thesis, that is to select the people for the Kreawartha grants and also for the Knapp grants. That was their main job because they had to read the proposals that the students prepared and then rank them in order to know which one should get the awards, because we never had enough money to give everyone an award.
Well, I can understand that. Well, who, if anyone, was responsible for the possibility of increasing honors courses back when it was possible?
Yeah. Well, that was the chairman's job. That was my job, to go around and try to convince chairmen and departments that they should offer honors courses, or to object when an honors course was dropped. At one time, the English department offered an honors course in the beginning English literature, and when they lost faculty and funds, they had to terminate the course. Well, I objected strenuously to Ed Lacey and to the chairman at that time. Ed was the assistant chairman, but they just felt they couldn't offer it because they had big classes as it was, and they couldn't offer a very small honors course. On the other hand, sometimes it was a matter of talking to a professor on the bus as we were riding back and forth, and convincing him that he ought to offer an honors course. This happened in the mathematics department with calculus, for example. It happened in Spanish with Professor Garofalo. In fact, I convinced him in the Shorewood Hills swimming pool one summer afternoon that the offer ought to offer an honor sequence in Italian, and it's now being offered.
Okay.
So that's the way it does.
But apparently the committee, faculty committee as a whole, didn't have much input.
No, and that's where I made a mistake, I'm sure. It would have been better to have given them more responsibility for doing something about it.
Well, let's see. While you were doing all of this, what kind of teaching were you doing?
Well, until 1966, I was still teaching one course each semester in the psychology department. The first semester in psychological testing, the second semester in personnel psychology, at that time I'd been teaching for 25 years. At that time, too, I was given some other assignments, and I was getting so loaded up that I realized I was falling behind in my own professional field. I couldn't keep up with the journals. I just didn't know what research was being done anymore, and I decided that something had to give. Either I should give up teaching, or I should give up the honors program. I enjoyed working with honors students so much that I decided that I'd give up the teaching instead. And I did that reluctantly because I enjoyed teaching. I think that I like to teach. I had taught high school. I had done a lot of lecturing for Professor Henman before I even received my PhD. And I think I was a very conscientious teacher. But I couldn't do everything because of some of these other assignments that had been directed in my way.
Did you ever go back to teaching?
No. I've occasionally gave guest lectures, but not on a regular basis. Here I guess I want to point out too that I think that the best students, my classes generally were very small, I'd say 15 to 25 students, but when the veterans came back after World War II in the late 40s. The personnel field was a very attractive one because of the work in personnel classification that had been done during World War II. So a lot of the veterans knew about personnel work and took my personnel course, which at times was 150 students. They were the best students, in my judgment, we've ever had at the university. They were hardworking. They knew what they wanted to do. They were anxious to get through just as fast as they could because they wanted to start their families and homes. It was just a pure delight to work with those students. One of whom, incidentally, was Lee Dreyfus. When Lee came back, he was very ambitious. He wanted to get through just as fast as he could. And we had limitations in those days on how many credits a student could take. Lee was a very able person, very bright, and we made exceptions to all our regulations, and his was one of the cases where I made an exception and let him take heavy loads. And he's never forgotten that. He's just recently, in fact this last spring, he talked to the roundtable group and he mentions the fact that Dean Rudicelli had allowed him to take heavy loads and finish up his work much faster than he otherwise could have. So he was very grateful for it. But they were a marvelous group of students as a group.
Well, he in particular is still pretty ambitious.
Yes. Now, I mentioned the fact that those in around 1966, I was busy doing some other things. Maybe I should mention what those other things are.
Let's get into some of those.
Okay. Well, one of them was the in 1962, President Harrington and Vice President Clodius asked me to conduct a study of foreign students and foreign faculty. Wisconsin always has been a school that's attracted many foreign students and faculty, and we were within the top, I think, five, maybe even the top three schools in foreign student enrollment in the country. We knew that the numbers were increasing rapidly and we wanted to do a better job for them. So I was still, at that time, chairman of the honors program. I was still teaching, but I took on this added responsibility of studying foreign students and foreign faculty. The things we did was to try to find out all we could about our current crop of foreign students and faculty. With the help of the Wisconsin Survey Research Lab, Harry Sharp was and still is director, we prepared a detailed questionnaire that was administered to all the foreign students and foreign faculty. It took several urgings to get this done, but I think we finally ended up with something like 90% of all the foreign students completed the questionnaire, which was then tabulated by the research lab and the results published. And it was an attempt to find out all we could about them, what the fields in which they were registered, how long they were here, the degrees they earned, the financial aid they came with, their English ability, and that was a very serious problem. It was a very detailed study that was made, and one that I enjoyed working with because I had spent a year in Japan, and I was interested in foreign students. It was also felt that I should visit other schools to see what was being done. So I visited almost all of the schools that had large foreign student enrollments. All the Big Ten schools, Harvard, MIT, Columbia, NYU on the East Coast, on the West Coast, University of California, Berkeley, and Stanford. So I pretty much covered the country in terms of what they were doing, talking to the foreign student advisors, to the deans of the graduate schools, to get all the information I could. And again, I followed kind of a special interview form that I had developed so that I could keep accurate record and compile the results. Well, all of this took a fair amount of time. In fact, from about 1962 to 65, I was involved in working on this project. I was still the chairman of the honors program, but I had an office in a different building, first over in the social studies building, and then in the old bank building down on University Avenue, where I could spend some time. The project ended in about a 700-page report that was presented to the president and vice president. And that took up quite a bit of my time, because writing is not easy for me, and to write 700 pages of type material took a real job, because I don't type. It all had to be written out longhand and then typed up from that. So it was a project, but it was interesting. So that's one thing that came in the early 60s.
Could you tell me something of the results of the project before we leave it?
Well, my job was merely to write the report and turn it over to Vice President Clodius. He then referred that to the foreign student advisor, who was Professor Elgin Milligan at the time. And they tried to follow the suggested changes and recommendations I made. I think I made something like 30 or 40 specific recommendations in regard to programs for foreign students and the help that should be given to the Madison Friends of International Students, which at that time was pretty much independent of the university and was not tied into the Foreign Student Advisor's office at all, which it subsequently was. So that I think that some values came out of it. Just, you know, how many of them were came to fruition, I don't know. But it was a very detailed report with very specific recommendations. And I think many of them were followed in terms of the programs for teaching English to the foreign students, for helping them with regard to visa problems, things like that. But I really don't know just what happened in terms of all the recommendations.
I'm curious about whether you discovered extensive differences in programs for foreign students in other universities in the Big Ten.
Well, Wisconsin really had a very good program, but I think we had more foreign students than any of the other Big Ten schools, maybe with the exception of Michigan. But certainly Michigan and Wisconsin were the two schools with the largest numbers. And I don't think there were great differences in the way they were administered. It was just that because we had so many, that we did have a program and an office that was directly concerned with them. Most of the other schools had foreign student advisors, so that was a problem, but I don't think they had as extensive a program as we did.
I said, well, pat ourselves on the back.
Then at the same time that I was doing this, another assignment or project was sent in my direction. Starting in 1963, President Harrington had obtained a $300,000 grant from a foundation, from the Carnegie Corporation, to work with Negro universities or black universities in the South. He appointed a committee called the Committee on Cooperation with Negro Universities, CCNU. And that was subsequently changed to CCDU, Committee on Cooperation with Developing Universities. I served as the first executive secretary for the faculty committee, And Jack Barbash was the first chairman of the faculty committee. The three schools that we worked with were North Carolina Central College, it became North Carolina Central University, North Carolina Agricultural and Mechanic University, and Texas Southern University in Houston. So two of the schools were in North Carolina, one in Texas. And the idea was that it was hoped that by having a prestigious Northern university work with Negro universities in the South, that perhaps some of the white institutions in the South would become interested in working with the black institutions. And I think that that did happen. I think that, when schools like the University of North Carolina saw that the University of Wisconsin was doing something like this, they realized that perhaps they had some responsibility and some obligation to help the black institutions. It started out primarily as an attempt to help the Southern universities, especially with upgrading faculty in terms of helping their faculty members get graduate degrees, so that a good share of the beginning money that was spent was to enable faculty members who were well along with their graduate studies but hadn't completed the work for a PhD to take time off and to get their PhDs. They didn't all come here. Some came here, but many had started their graduate work elsewhere, and they were given funds to return there and to get their degrees. So that was one of the important emphases of this committee.
But who provided the funds?
The Carnegie Grant.
I see.
The Carnegie Foundation supplied the money. And we had to develop, you know, ways of getting the money down there. And I hadn't done any of this kind of work because I'd never been involved in budgeting before. But we developed forms for transferring money, funds from here to the institution to take care of expenses. A lot of it also dealt with working with individual offices there, with the registrar's office. People from our registrar's office would go down to their institutions and talk to the people and help them set up new procedures and registration. With work in the libraries, with computers, especially with the teaching of English. The man at North Carolina Central in charge of the work was Cecil Patterson, who was an English professor. And he worked very closely with our English department to develop better ways of teaching English. It was a very worthwhile project. And in fact, the committee is still functioning. There still is a committee that is doing this. My work ended in 1969 after I had served as the secretary and also as chairman and as a regular committee member. Joe Corey from our faculty was very active and has been very active, but there have been several people that have taken over this work, and more recently it's been located in the Extension Department of University. But it was an exciting experience, and it was a new kind of experience for most of us that went down to those institutions, and a large number of our faculty did go down there, several of them to teach for a semester or a year, but more often on a short-term basis of several days or a week or two, to work with the different departments and also with the different offices. So it became not just a matter of upgrading faculty, but upgrading their departments so that they could earn accreditation in certain areas. Our School of Engineering, for example, worked with the North Carolina A&M to get them accredited in engineering.
Was this ever successful?
Yes, yeah, it was. they became an accredited institution. So it I think we did a lot with $300,000 in those days. I know at first when I heard the figure $300,000, I thought, oh, how will we ever spend that? We didn't have any difficulty spending it.
You said you were chairman of this committee for a number of years. Who else was on the committee? From where? What parts of the university did the committee?
Well, we tried to get representatives from all schools. I know that Max Carbon in engineering, Ralph Benedict in engineering, Bob Dienermeyer in ag school. I'd have to get out my file to remember some of the others, but those were some of the people on the original committee I know. Can't think of anyone else right now.
Yeah, it's probably a matter of record someplace anyway.
Now, incidentally, all of my records are in that box right there.
Which box? I see several.
And they're being sent to Velma Richardson, because she is now the person in the extension that is sort of the secretary for that program.
Are these records she's going to want to use?
These are all the records that I accumulated in those two boxes that I'm going to be sending down to her.
But you haven't thought of putting them in the archives, had you?
Well, she's still involved in them.
Well,
she's
if they're records she would still be referring to, then it's premature to think of the archives.
Well, you know, before I send them, I'm going to point out to her that all my other records that I'm not sending to other offices will go to archives. I've talked to Mr. Cook about that already.
Oh, good.
But that other box is going to Jack Kelsby. That's all of the records from the SOAR program that I mentioned.
Yes, that's right.
So that the records that we have will not be thrown away, but she said that they would be very much interested in getting the materials.
Oh, yes.
Well, so that's why in 1966 I felt that I had to give up something, because at that time I was still chairman of the honors program, I was teaching in the psych department, I was involved in CCNU, I was involved in the foreign student study, and I just realized that I was being cut into little pieces. So that's why I gave up teaching in 1966.
Oh, you had taught by then for
25 years. Yes,
this is a considerable period.
But I still missed the teaching.
Yeah, it's something special. You mentioned, and I know you did this before you were doing all this, you mentioned something about your association with Japan, and I know you spent a year there. This goes back in time a bit.
Yeah, that came about in the early 1950s. 1951-52, that year. I had never had anything to do with Japan or with foreign students particularly, but somehow or other my name was suggested to Wesley Lloyd, who at that time was the dean of students at Brigham Young University in Utah. He had been appointed by the American Council on Education to formulate a faculty that would go to Japan for a year to study Japanese universities, especially in terms of student personnel work. The project itself was called the Japanese Universities Institutes for Student Personnel Services. A faculty of five or six of us was pulled together. One other person from Wisconsin, Gordon Klupp, who was very active in student affairs at that time. The other members were Leona Felsted from a small college in Ohio, Morris Wolf from Kansas State, and Henry Borrow, another psychologist from the University of Minnesota. In fact, Henry this year is the president of Division 17, which is a division of counseling psychology of the American Psychological Association. So there were two of us were psychologists. We constituted a faculty that conducted a 3 months institutes for Japanese professors, deans, presidents of colleges and universities, trying to help them learn something about student personnel services, because at that time they were having a great deal of difficulty with student problems. This was right at the end of the occupation. In fact, the occupation ended in May of 1951 when we were over there. But the schools were having problems with student uprisings. It was at times a touch and go situation.
What was the basis for uprisings?
Well, they were. It was just a general objection to the government, to the relationships with the United States, with foreigners coming in and trying to tell them what to do. It was just. I guess it was a lot like the student uprisings of the late 1960s in our country, except that there was a different purpose at that time.
Well, but, how did they accept you in that case?
Well, they didn't always accept us. When we were going into Kyoto University, our offices were in the Rockefeller Library there. Every morning, as we'd come through the gate, because there's a wall around the university grounds, we'd be handed a little sheet in Japanese saying, "Foreigners, go home." But they handed it to us with a smile and a bow. They didn't object to us as individuals, they just objected to the idea, or somebody told them they should hand these things out. We had no animosity shown toward us whatsoever. But they just didn't think that we should be there. That was a situation. Well, anyway, we conducted these 3 months institutes, one in Kyoto, one in Fukuoka on the southern island of Kyushu, and one in Tokyo at Tokyo University. Besides the three institutes, we visited altogether 80 or 90 different colleges and universities in the country. Talking to faculty members, to deans, to presidents, about this area of student personnel work, about counseling, about student activities, about faculty advising, about psychological testing and admission to universities, about student personnel administration generally. It was interesting because the day would start with a lecture by one of us, and it had to be, we had no opportunity to learn Japanese, so we lectured in English, but each of us had an interpreter who would then translate into Japanese, so that if my lecture dealt with psychological testing, I would start out by saying, "This morning I'm going to discuss the criteria that one should have for establishing an intelligence test for admission to colleges." Then I'd have to stop, and my interpreter would try to put that into Japanese. Well, in some cases, they didn't have the right Japanese words, so that I'd have to elaborate a little bit and indicate what I meant by intelligence. Well, it got so that we could lecture, say a sentence or two, stop, and wait for it to be translated. Then after that, then we broke down into five or six small groups so that each one of us had a group of about 15 professors, presidents, and deans within our group, and we would discuss what had been taken up in the lecture or work on some other aspect of it in terms of their own schools, again with our interpreter, so that the interpreter sat next to us and would whisper in my ear what the others were saying in Japanese, because at that time very few of the group we were working with could speak English. The very old professors could, because they had learned English before the start of World War II, or the very young ones could. But most of them fell in that period when they didn't learn English in the Japanese schools, so that we had to use an interpreter all the time. Incidentally, when I came back after that year, that fall when I started teaching again in the fall of 52, the first time I went to class, I said, well, this morning we're going to discuss the criteria of a good psychological test. And I stopped and waited to have that translated. There wasn't any translation because I was saying it in English, and all of my students in my own classes here understood English. But you get in the habit of lecturing like with an interpreter, and you just stop after every sentence or two. But I survived. I learned not to stop after a while. Well, it was a great experience. The unfortunate part of it was that we couldn't take our families with us because we traveled so much and had to stay in Army billets. We were classified as DACs, Department of Army Civilians. So we stayed in Army quarters. We ate in Army quarters. We had the advantages of the PX. There were some advantages, but there were some handicaps in that we were away from our families for a whole year.
This calendar year or the academic year?
No, it was from July until the following August, just about 13 months altogether.
Oh, worse than a year.
Yeah, it was a long time.
What kind of groups came to your institutes?
Well, these were all men from colleges and universities who either, as I say, were presidents of the colleges or deans, or in some cases, faculty members that were asked to come in order to learn something about this new responsibility that they were going to take over with the changed university system that went into effect. And it was quite different from the old system, so that there wasn't anything like student personnel work in the pre-war Japanese university or college.
What kind of changes did you suggest to them?
Well,
what kind of new things that they hadn't been doing?
Well, such as, for example, the use of better testing techniques for admitting students. As it was, the procedure that was used was a very harrowing experience for any secondary school student who tried to get into a university or a college. And we suggested, we met with a Japanese psychologist to recommend different kinds of tests than they were using. In terms of counseling students, in the admission of women, which was almost unheard of in pre-war Japan, things of that type, and it's been changed. I think that the fact that Japan sent so many students to this country after the war for their education helped a great deal. And Wisconsin was one of the leaders, especially with Japanese.
Was it?
Oh yes, yeah. Now that's some of the work that I think I mentioned Professor Regal. Institutes, the English language institutes that he conducted after World War II for foreign students, but especially those from Japan. In fact, one of them that was in one of those institutes, Dai Yamauchi, is now the president of the Mainichi, which is the largest newspaper in Tokyo. So that he's an alumnus of the University of Wisconsin now.
I want to be proud of, I think.
But it was a great experience. I know when we went over there, I think some of us were a little hesitant and perhaps a little wary even of the kind of reception we would receive. And yet, I don't think I've ever been treated better in my life than the year that I was in Japan. I mean, we were, it didn't appear that we were the victors and they were the losers in the war. I mean, there was no feeling of animosity or hatred or any bad feelings at all between us. It was a great experience, really.
They objected just to foreigners in general?
It was the students that were objecting, mm-hmm. not the people that we were working with. We didn't have any trouble there because this was a project that was a joint project of the American military. MacArthur was our boss at the time, and Monbisho, which was the Japanese Ministry of Education. It was a joint project with a Japanese faculty committee that established and that worked with us in each of the institutes. And each one of us had a Japanese colleague that we worked with.
Oh, so one person the entire year?
That's right. No, one person in each of the schools.
I see.
That we worked at, so that we had one person that was our Japanese colleague for each of the three institutes.
That must have been very helpful.
It was, yeah. Yes, we still keep in touch with some of them at Christmas time with Christmas letters, and we always enjoy their Christmas cards because they're really beautiful.
Can I imagine?
Yeah. Well, that was, I would say, one of the highlights of my Wisconsin experience.
Well, now, somewhere I came across the fact that there were riots in Japan in the early 60s sometime, which canceled a trip there, projected trip by President Eisenhower. Do you know anything about that?
No, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I think that, you know, in any country, there's a dissident group, a group of radicals and ultra-liberals that are going to raise problems. We certainly have it, you know, right in this country. We have it right in Madison. We have it right in the University of Wisconsin.
That's true.
No, it wasn't a large group, but it was a group that was very active. Zen Gakuin was the name of that. It was an ultra-radical student group called Zen Gakuin, and they were the ones that had a small clientele, especially in Tokyo University and Kyoto University, those two. And since we started our institutes in Kyoto, that was where we had most difficulties. But I know that when the occupation ended in May of 51, at that time we were conducting the institute in Tokyo University. That day we did not go on campus because we were advised just to stay in the place we were staying, which was the Daiichi Hotel. And not to go out even, because we were going to we always had the use of army cars, and they just didn't want to incite any of the radical Japanese Zen Gakuin group. So we stayed in the hotel that day.
But just one day.
Just one day, yeah. And after that, there was no problem. That was when the occupation ended. And I think it was. I'm not sure, I think it was May 1st, 1951. 52, excuse me, it was 50, the 51-52 year. Mm-hmm. Well, now what?
Yeah.
I think that covers pretty much the main activities. I haven't said very much about the SOAR program.
We touched on it, but
we
didn't go into it too much.
Well, the SOAR program started in the middle 60s. I think that I started in 67, and I think I was right in the very beginning of it. This was an attempt to help new entering freshmen and transfer students Become better acquainted with the university before the hectic registration period each fall.
I think you did talk about
I guess
that.
I did, yeah.
I think you did. That sounds familiar.
But that's I think, a great program, and one that is very helpful to students. The university has done a good job there. I think that not only the students, but the parents who come down. In fact, if you walk around the campus now, you'll see groups of parents on a tour. And I know the ones that I've talked to that have been close friends or relatives of ours have indicated they thought this was one of the best programs the university could possibly have for new students and their parents.
Sounds very valuable. Now, we got into the conferences on student life and higher education.
No.
I don't think we have.
Well, this was something that began in the early 50s. I think 1953 was the first year, and it lasted through the 50s into the early 60s, maybe through 1962-63. These were conferences or institutes sponsored by the Council Board of Associated Research Councils for foreign Fulbright scholars. It was designed to give them a picture of student life and higher education in this country before they returned to their own countries. In other words, this was at the end of their experience. Many of the foreign scholars that come here are so immersed in their own academic fields, in biochemistry, in soils, in civil engineering, whatever it happens to be, that they see almost nothing of the rest of the campus. Now, that's not quite as much of a problem on our campus as it is on some others because of the excellent work that the Madison Friends of International Students do with foreign students and with foreign scholars. But in many schools, these foreign scholars are in their labs all the time, and they just don't see the rest of the university at all. Well, the Associated Research Councils, and with help from the Hazen Foundation, with the financial help from the Hazen Foundation, developed these one-week institutes, approximately a week, sponsored by the Committee on International Exchanges, to bring Americans and the scholars together and to cover some of these areas. The first one was held in 1953 at Haverford College. Then there were several that were held at the University of Chicago, one at Michigan State. We held one here at the University of Wisconsin. Elizabeth Lam, L-A-M, of the Associated Research Councils was the guiding light in setting these up, assisted by Bob Strozier, who at that time was the Dean of Students at the University of Chicago. And I was on the committee to help plan them, along with Helen White. Oh, there were representatives from throughout the country. Father Hesburgh at Notre Dame, I know, was on. There must have been a committee of 10 people or so. The conferences were pretty generally organized around the regular institute procedure, that is, with lectures, small discussion groups, all the conferees, both American and foreign, living together, eating together, visiting together, walking the hills together. It was a good way for them to meet people outside of their own field. But I think that it was really designed to give them a picture of what higher education and student life is like. And in many cases, it varies a great deal from their own experiences in their own countries. So that it was something that covered many different fields. I know that one of the values, I think, was the opportunity to visit with people from the different countries, because it wasn't just all Japanese being in one group. It was people from Europe, from Africa, from Asia meeting and discussing these problems jointly. So it was a very worthwhile experience. I would guess that it's something that would be even worthwhile now, except that I suppose the Hazen Foundation ran out of money for it. But it was a very good investment. And I know that the people that participated in it felt that they got a great deal out of it.
It sounds like it could have been very helpful indeed, because the individuals were confronting similar kinds of problems and situations, but bringing to them varying backgrounds.
Now, and as I say, they tried to give them a picture of American higher education, especially in terms of student life. That was the project. We also, I know one of the assignments I had was to collate materials that they could take home with them, describing different aspects of student life and higher education throughout the country. So I wrote to a lot of my friends in other institutions and asked them to send enough copies of brochures and bulletins and things of that nature so that each of the foreign scholars could collect one and take them home with them, so that they received a lot of material in one place where it was all available for them. But that was one of the more enjoyable aspects of my foreign relations assignments.
Oh, that sounds very pleasant. Now, what was the Brittingham Viking Scholars and International Scholars about?
Well, in 1953, Tom Brittingham Jr. sent a student to Wisconsin for a year's experience. It was a family friend that he helped subsidize, and he wanted the student to experience life in an American university. And he was especially interested that the student not be too academically oriented. He wanted the student to participate in fraternity experiences. He wanted him to participate in extracurricular activities to get an overall picture. Mr. Brittingham was very impressed with the experience that this first student had, and starting in 1954, he started sending over a group of students from the Scandinavian countries. The first year, they were students from Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. And there must have been, I don't know, 7 or 8 students, maybe.
Where did the first student come from?
I think the first one came from Sweden, but I'm not sure, because I had nothing to do with the first one. I was asked to serve as the advisor for the first group that came in 1954. I was the faculty advisor, or the academic advisor. I had to help them make out a program, and that was a real problem, because in some cases their English wasn't that good, and they were interested in different areas. Mr. Brittingham had selected these students on the basis that these were likely to be the leaders of their country in future years. At least that's what he was trying to select people that would become leaders within their countries subsequently.
Not purely academicians.
Not just academicians, but just leaders. He wanted them to play an important role in their country's future. And that was the basis on which he sent them there. For 1 year only. They had to go back after 1 year. They could take almost anything that they wanted to take, with the help of an advisor. He didn't insist that they all join a fraternity, but he strongly urged them to join a fraternity. He wanted them to have that experience, and most of them did. They were an interesting group. some of them had academic problems. I know in looking through my file recently, I found a letter I had written to Mr. Brittingham in the fall of that first year. Must have been in, well, it was after the 6 weeks exams had been collated, and I had that information, and some of the students weren't doing very well academically. And I told Mr. Brittingham so, and I received a letter back from him in which he indicated that he expected them to be good students, and he was writing a letter to all those who weren't. So there was a marked improvement in the academic quality of the students by the 12 weeks time, because they knew a good thing when they had it, and they weren't going to lose out on an experience like this. And they had just thought that they didn't have to work very hard in an American university and they could get by. Well, they found out that they had to work.
Somebody was paying attention.
That's right. And they did much better after that. This program lasted until 1961. And after a few years, he started another program. The first one was called the Brittingham Viking Scholars. Then he decided that he wanted to bring in students from other countries, and also women students. The first group were all men.
And how large a group was the early one?
Well, it was about 7 or 8, I would say, the first group. Then after that, the international scholars were about the same number, 8 or 9, 10, something like that. But they were from all over, and how he selected them, I don't know. There were even some from Japan.
And some were women.
And some were women. Again, by this time there were so many that I couldn't serve as the sole advisor, and some of the other deans, Dean Young and Dean Regal, also served as advisors to some of these students. The international scholars were a different group. In fact, we used to refer to the Vikings as the Cadillac program, and the international scholars as the Ford program.
Can you draw this comparison to the car suggests?
I'm not so sure you can do it at the present time, but back in those days there was a real difference between the two. In other words, it wasn't as select a group, it wasn't as elitist a group. It wasn't, I don't think they were endowed, the international scholars, I don't think received as good stipends as the Brittingham Viking group were receiving. But they were a very interesting group, and in some ways they were better students. They were, they just did better academically, at least. Now, whether they were better students, I don't know, but at least they got better grades than the Viking group did. But it was a great group to work with. We'd have them out to dinner at our home, and it was really quite an experience. But just again because of the variation in their backgrounds and in the countries from which they came, it was a good assignment. That one I thoroughly enjoyed.
I wonder if there was any significant difference in the backgrounds of the two groups.
I think so. I think that the Brittingham Viking students came from the elite of the Scandinavian countries, from the elite families. I know that one of them, for example, showed me a picture of his home. Well, his home was a castle, is what it was. And I visited in 1955, I was in Denmark, and I visited the home of one of the students. It was a boy whose father owned the best bakery shop on the main street in Copenhagen, and their apartment was right above the store. And their apartment was just loaded with art pictures, Rubens, Cezanne, just first-class art.
Originals, you're saying?
These were originals. These were originals. And then I was invited for a weekend at their summer home. Well, it was a different life than I was used to living. But it was fun for a weekend.
Oh, sure.
No, it was a different group. I don't think that the international scholars came from families of that type.
This may have had some effect on their motivation and whatnot.
I'd be interested now, since this was back in the middle 1950s, 25 years ago, to see what happened to that group. I still have all their names, and if I ever have an opportunity to get to...
If you run out of other things to
England or to Denmark and Norway and Sweden, I'm going to see if I can find out what happened to that group, because it would be interesting to see how many of them
came
here. You
make a very interesting study of that.
Yeah.
If the idea was to train people who might become leaders, whether it worked out or not.
Well, I have all of their files for the years that I was the advisor here, and their names are all listed there, so that a follow-up study could be made of that group.
Yeah, maybe somebody could write a thesis on that.
They make a great project, I think.
Oh, I think so too.
Yeah, get some money to spend a couple of months or a year visiting everybody over there that was involved in it.
Tape recordings.
Yes. I'll have to look into that. You've given me an idea now.
Well, sounds...
I've said that one of the things I was going to do when I retired, now I've been retired for almost 2 years, and I haven't even gone through these files that I have, plus a whole lot more in the other side of the hallway here, that I was going to write up a history of the honors program, which has never been done, and even maybe write up a history of the College of Letters and Science. Well, that's maybe a little too ambitious, but I certainly ought to write up a history of the honors program, and that's something that I still intend to do someday.
Well, you were so closely involved with it that you're the logical person to do it, I think. Now, we talked about the Woodrow Wilson graduate fellowships.
Well, that was a program that was in effect in the middle 60s through 1971. And I was involved in it from 1965 to 1971. The Woodrow Wilson graduate fellowships had funds that enabled them to give graduate fellowships to graduating seniors from American universities who planned to be college teachers. This was at the time when there was a shortage of college teachers, and in order to encourage top-notch students to go into college teaching, the Woodrow Wilson graduate fellowships were established, and they were very good fellowships. I mean, with a good stipend, maybe not quite as good as a National Science Foundation fellowship, but still one of the elite fellowships. I was the campus representative, first with David Lovejoy of the History Department, and then later on with Jim Nelson of the English Department.
Well, how did you get involved with this?
Somebody asked me to serve. I suppose, I think Leon Epstein did, but I'm not sure. All I know is that I was asked to be one of the representatives, and there had been other representatives earlier, so just why, I don't know. And I suppose because I was connected with the honors program, and would naturally know a lot of the honors students that might qualify for a fellowship of this type. Well, what we did was to distribute information to all departments and to all faculty members about the fellowships, encouraging them to nominate students. The students who, in order to apply, had to complete an application form. These were sent to Princeton, and there certain students were invited to attend a meeting. At this meeting, we explained in some detail then just what had to be done and how they should complete the procedures and the application forms. what was involved, what kind of stipends and other expenses they could expect to get if they won the award. And then a very detailed application form had to be filled out. From these, certain students were recommended for interviews by a regional committee. Wisconsin was in a committee of several of the states around here. And at one time, the chairman of that group was a man at Marquette, another time at the University of Iowa. He had faculty members from different institutions who served then as the interviewing committee. And these students had to report to this committee and be interviewed for the award, for the selection. Professor Sieghard Riegel in the German department was on that committee for selecting people. And he's had some interesting experiences in this procedure. Well, before the students went to their interviews, we had meetings for them. We tried to not proctor them, but we tried to tell them what they could expect to find in the interview. How to make a good interview. How to make the best presentation. To have some ideas of what they wanted to do in their graduate study. In other words, to have very specific proposals for their graduate work. To do some thinking about what they were going to say if they received certain kinds of questions. We didn't ask them questions, but we just explained that these are the kinds of things that you're likely to be asked in the interview. And we had gotten these from people here at Wisconsin who had served on these interviewing committees, so that if a student said that he was fluent in French, I said, you want to be pretty sure that you are fluent in French, because somebody may ask you something in French, and if you can't say oui, oui, you're going to be out of luck. So that it was just a matter of doing our best to help the students prepare themselves for the interviews. Well, our students did very well. I mean, I don't know if they did as well as some of the Eastern schools, because generally it seems the Eastern schools get most graduate fellowships. I know Dave Cronin even wrote a letter to some of the foundations about the fact that he thought that Eastern schools were overrated in terms of their fellowship grantees. But we did very well, and it was a nice group to work with, and many of the kids that we helped with were successful in their applications. But it ended in 71 for two reasons. First of all, they ran out of money, and that's always a good reason for terminating a program. But even more so, I think, was the fact that there began to be an oversupply of college teachers. And the foundation felt that there was no longer the need to subsidize prospective college teachers. I think that's what really happened.
Well, I've heard this suggested that certainly in some fields this was very much the case.
Yeah.
They had many more than they needed. And even departments here were considering their requirements for entering graduate work and talking about limiting the number of graduate students that they would accept.
Yeah. Well, it was a good program, but it just outran its need. That's what happened, I think.
You've noted, and I recall that you, as a member of the faculty, were a member of the faculty assembly and ultimately the faculty senate, or did you just attend?
No, the university faculty assembly was an organization that included representatives from all the different campuses of the university. So it wasn't just a Madison organization, but it had people from Extension, from Green Bay, from Milwaukee, from Parkside. I think that's before we actually got into the...
Before some merger.
Before merger, that's right.
I suppose the center system perhaps also had...
That's right. And I was a member of the faculty assembly from 1967 to 73.
Did you have to be elected to this?
You had to be... This was an election procedure, yes. And meetings were held in different places, I mean, so that
different
it meant...
Different campuses? And
on different campuses, so that it wasn't Madison dominated. And it was an attempt to coordinate and to, again, share experiences, I think. It only lasted for 6 years, I think, so that it wasn't a long-time organization. Now, the Faculty Senate, I was an elected member from 1970 to 74, but never played a very active role in it other than attending regularly. I think that I'm sure I did not miss a single meeting of the Faculty Senate all the time that I was a member. And I guess I could say the same thing about being on the LNS Faculty Senate from 73 to 77, during that four-year period. I don't think that I missed a single meeting, but again, did not play a very active role in it. I know that often issues would arise where I felt that I didn't know a great deal about the particular issue, since I wasn't a full-time teaching faculty member, but was more an administrator than I was a faculty member. And often what I would do, I would try to see how two particular people would vote, or how they would, what side they would take. One was Helen White, and the other was Jack Barbash. I had a great deal of confidence in the judgment of both of those people, and if I felt I didn't know how to take a particular stand, I'd see what stand they took, and usually I'd vote with them. Now, that may not be, you know, the right thing to do, but I guess it's just that I respected them enough that I felt I wouldn't be too far wrong if I was on their side of the issue.
Of course, you'd have a problem if they were on different sides, from the other.
Often, they were. Most of the time, they were on the same side, I discovered. Helen White was a marvelous person. I think that she's one of the greatest women I know. Let me tell you one incident that occurred here. At the time I was involved in the foreign student study, I was having a terrible time writing it up because I do not write very easily. For one thing, I don't type. That meant everything had to be written longhand. And writing is just not one of my strong points, because all of my life I've been a counselor, and I talk more than I write. I was walking down the hill with Helen one noon, complaining about the difficulty of my writing experience and how I just was struggling to get through every chapter, and complaining bitterly about how about this experience, saying how much I envied her the ability to write so easily and so well. She stopped, put her hand on my shoulder, looked down at me because she was taller than I was, and said, "Chet, I want you to know that I struggle over every sentence." Well, I felt a lot better, because if Helen White has to struggle over every sentence, then who am I to complain about my difficulty in writing? But that's an indication of the kind of person that Helen White was. I think she's one of the greatest women Wisconsin's ever had, and certainly one of my best friends. Well, that's about the extent of my Faculty Senate and Faculty Assembly experience, I would say.
Well, I do have one little question. What prompted you to be so regular in attendance?
I guess it's just that I've always been meticulous about getting someplace on time or about living up to a responsibility. I know that I sometimes drive my wife wild because I'm ready to go someplace about 10 or 15 minutes before we're supposed to leave and way before she's ready to leave. This is something I learned from my father, I think, that if he was going any place, he was always ready in plenty of time and he always got to where he had to go. And I think it's just something that I learned as a boy, that if you're a member of something, you should attend its meetings and do the job that you're supposed to do. That's part of my youthful upbringing, I think. Which has stayed with me. And I enjoyed it, too. I mean, I wanted to know what was happening in the university, and I think that if you attend the meetings of the Senate or the Assembly regularly, you find out what's happening.
Did you feel that these were effective groups in the relationship to university or campus policy?
I felt that the faculty senate system was a good system, much better than having faculty meetings. In a faculty meeting, it was too easy for a small group to pack the meeting and to have the vote go in their direction. And even though I know there are complaints about the faculty senate setup, I still think that overall it's a better plan than just having open faculty meetings. The same people usually come to faculty meetings. Now it's true the same people come to faculty senate meetings, but it's a more representative group, and if it's not, then a quorum isn't obtained and no action can be taken. But I know that in some LNS faculty meetings, decisions were made on the basis of people who were there where it was a packed session, and I felt very bitter about that. And I can give a specific example.
Oh, please.
At the time we were discussing the procedure of dropping courses and beyond the 8 weeks deadline. At one time, a student couldn't drop a course beyond the 6 weeks deadline. That was extended to the 8 weeks, the first 8 weeks of the semester. Then action was suggested that it be extended to a 12-week deadline, and I objected very strenuously to that extension. The committee was able to get an affirmative vote to their recommendation that suggested this, and I think it was by one vote because of the very small attendance at that particular LNS faculty meeting. If it had been a normal Senate meeting, I'm sure that regulation never would have been passed. But by having all the committee members there, there were so few other faculty members that they just passed it entirely on the basis of the committee members.
Why were you opposed to this result?
I just felt that was the wrong approach. It seems to me that it's educationally and psychologically disadvantageous to let a student start a course believing that he could stay with it for 12 weeks and then at that time drop it. I don't think that's the way to have motivation for learning, knowing that you can go through 12/16 of a semester and drop the course at that time without any penalty. I just think that's poor learning. Since I taught a course in the psychology of learning, I thought I knew something about it, and I don't think that's the way you learn, by starting a course knowing that you can drop it when it's 3/4 over. Mm. So I objected to it on that basis. Every once in a while I've lost on some of these issues that have come up. Here's another example where I did.
Well, there's another item that maybe, I don't know which group came up in, probably the Senate, no, it was before the Senate, the question of credits for summer session. The minimum credits for summer session.
Yeah, well, that, no,
there was a change projected.
Yeah, no, that was part of the same issue. It wasn't summer session.
Well,
it was the minimum program that was allowed. It used to be that our college required that students had to carry a 12-credit load unless there was some reason for carrying less than 12 credits. If a student was in poor health, he could carry less than 12 credits. If he worked, he could carry less than 12 credits. If there were family problems, like a housewife, for example, they could carry as few credits as they wanted. But generally, students had to take a 12-credit program. Well, part of the same regulation in regard to dropping courses also pertained to the the minimum amount of credits that a student had to carry. This was also changed at the same time and on the same vote. And I objected to that because I thought that all students should be carrying 12 credits rather than any number of credits, because some students could get higher grade point averages. Some students could, by carrying lighter program loads, prolong the time in which it takes to get a degree because they could afford to do so financially. At the same time, they were improving their grade point averages because it would be easier to get high grades on, say, 6 credits than they could if they had to carry 12 credits. This, I thought, was very unfair to the student who couldn't afford to prolong the time for him to get a degree. And that's why I objected to reducing that 12-credit minimum to any amount.
Well, how about the student who had to be partly or maybe wholly self-supporting and who maybe couldn't
take a whole
load?
We've always allowed students to carry reduced programs if they had an outside workload. There was no problem there. That's been true from the time when I started working in the office in 1936. You could carry a reduced program if you had a job. You could carry it if you were in ill health. You could carry it if there were emotional problems or family problems.
I see. So this ruling merely applied to the full-time student who had none of these.
That's right. And you see what some students were doing. For example, they would start out carrying a very difficult course like organic chemistry, which is a requirement for medical school, with maybe one or two other courses where the student who couldn't afford to prolong the time for getting a degree would have to carry a full program. Well, that meant that the student had a much better chance of getting a good grade in organic chemistry if he had a lighter load. And I objected to that. I didn't think it was fair to the student whose situation financially prevented him from carrying the light load.
He had to get through as fast as he could.
That's right, yeah. And we know, for example, that there were students in regard to that 12-week deadline for dropping courses, and these two things came up in the same meeting. They were part of the same committee recommendation. We know, for example, that there were students in taking organic chemistry who would take 12 weeks of it. They'd have a C in it at that time. They'd drop the course that semester. They'd repeat the course the next semester and were competing against students taking it for the first time. Well, taking organic chemistry the second time is a breeze. They're almost sure to get at least a B and probably an A. And that just wasn't fair to the student who was taking organic for the first time. So those were some of the arguments that we used and that we lost by one vote in the final decision.
Yeah, they can still drop it 12 weeks, can't they?
They can still drop it, that's right. Yeah. I still think it's wrong.
Well, maybe someday they'll change it. Who knows?